April 28th for a special concert with his live band presented by Capital Bop. That's Sunday, April 28th at Songbird in Northeast DC. Also on the bill is Baltimore's Conjure Collective, a new group you won't want to miss. Info at capitalbop.com. That's CAPITALBOP.com.
The Margin with Dia Burt Miller.
My guest today is Sally Ashton. Sally Ashton is a writer and teacher. She's the editor of the DMQ Review. From 2011 to 2013, she served as the Poet Laureate of Santa Clara County in California. Her most recent book is Listening to Mars, published by Cornerstone Press. How are you doing this morning, Sally?
Good morning, Ethelbert. I'm happy to be here and be sitting with you.
And it is very morning where you are.
Yeah, it's very morning. The moon is still up out here.
Well, you know, the last time I saw you, we were sitting on what they call what, the edge of the world there on the Bennington campus.
<That's right>.
And so I want to go back to that moment, you know.
Yes.
And I want to ask you this, because this might be of importance, of interest to our listeners. Why did you decide, Sally, to pursue an MFA degree in creative writing? And why did you select a low residency program?
Okay, it's a longer story than I have a lot of time for, but because I came back, was a returning student, and just was stumbling around in GE, and creative writing came up, and just was sort of like finding my real self, I guess you'd say. And when I found out there was such a thing as an MFA program, where you could just really dive in and work with mentor professors like yourself, I was like thrilled. And I still had two kids at home still. So the low res program for me, I had just come through the local university, San Jose State, to complete my bachelor's. And I'd spent about 2 or 3 years there. So a move was not possible in terms of like just uproot and go leave the family. I mean, guess it was possible, but not what I chose to do. So the MFA program just works marvelously that way, where you have 2 weeks of intense community with writers and teachers, and then you're back home to do the solo work of writing, fitting it into the rest of ongoing life.
Yeah, talk about that, because, you know, it seems like you had to make a family decision, you know. And I know, for example, for many people in the program, you know, you come back and how do you balance your regular life? You know, you're raising children. I mean, that can be very demanding.
Yeah. Yeah. At the time, I was I didn't have a full-time job, so I was able to juggle things pretty easily. They'd go off to school and I would go to school, and then you know, for a couple hours, or when they're watching TV, you know, they were older. But I missed my youngest son's middle school graduation. Was right, you know, the summer residency was right then. You have to let go of some things and be okay with that. Or, you know, I could have extended my stay there. But yeah, there's a lot of juggling going on. And you have to kind of leave some of the roles that everyone has depended on you for, and hand them off or let them fall, you know, whichever works out.
Well, yeah. You graduated from the Bennington Writing Seminars in 2003.
Yes.
Did the program help you find your voice?
Although to me, in some ways, voice keeps changing, and I feel like because in some ways you're getting to know yourself, that's the kind of sense of voice. You're also getting to, I've been seeing more and more that poetry is a voice, the listening voice and the speaking voice of the poet, and kind of distinguishing between those two and finding them. I was certainly exposed to so many voices. So I think you have to come home and sort that out. Do I want to sound like so-and-so or so-and-so? And you're reading so much, and you're so impressed by so many of your co-students. And then it just, you know, it just takes some time to settle back into, okay, you know, who is it that I am and what do I want to write, and finding your stuff, which does seem to change, you know, the focus.
Did your ideas of how to construct a poem change?
Oh, absolutely. I think that I'm a person who kind of naturally, without any training, I could write like an iambic pentameter super easily. It just, so I kind of, when I was at Bennington and was exposed particularly to the prose poem and some looser forms, that was a real accelerant for me, a real kind of gave me a sense of freedom to explore and to push myself, to challenge myself, really, to like let go of the formalisms that were kind of inbred. I had a very musical family. You know, my grandfather had, you know, old kind of poetry memories that he would quote, and he's Irish, and he would sing a lot, you know, so you kind of get those sort of formal rhythms and the Bible in your mind or in your ear. And not that they aren't, I think those are good backgrounds, but to be able to diverge for me was important to do, because it felt like I always just kind of went into one place.
Right. You know, I know that before a student completes the seminars at Bennington, they have to give a major lecture to their class. What did you talk about?
Yeah. You know, I started the program in 2001 in June. And so I think my whole class was impacted by 9/11. And I started writing, actually, I think you were my advisor at the time when I was trying to pull it all together. And I had some interest in, well, I was interested in the hero, and I still am, because of, in my undergrad, I had worked with Harvey Birenbaum, who and took a number of studies in tradition, in myth. So in terms of the hero and the hero's journey, and then Byron had this kind of hero's journey right at the beginning of modernism, you know, was kind of counter. Anyway, you could see I'm still back in that paper. And you had said, you know, stop, this is like a doctoral thesis, go do something else. So I ended up doing writing in times of, you know, if you told me you were going to ask me this, I would have had the title of it. But it's writing at times of grief, or in different, you know, I was basically talking about how to write through these traumatic times. In times of pain, a formal feeling comes. I think I might have been my subtitle, the Emily Dickinson line. So, yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things that I always remember, Liam Rector, when he was directing the program, you know, he was saying that we wanted to produce men and women of letters. So now you, Sally Ashton, you've completed the program at Bennington. What were you thinking about doing? You know, now I have a degree. Were you thinking about teaching? Were you thinking about, you know, did you have a process where, okay, I've got this degree, it makes me more marketable?
Yeah. You know, I wasn't thinking those things at the time, because my daily life was still very much wrapped up in, you know, a middle school son and a high school age daughter. So, you know, I was doing sort of a parallel thing, which felt like I was reviving a part of my person that I'd kind of put to rest a couple of decades before. So the MFA program itself, it seemed like I was going to go deeper and wider, and it was going to be an adventure, you know, just going to go to Vermont. I'd never been to Vermont. There were just it just felt like this grand opening. Okay. So then along the way, then you realize, oh, I could teach with this degree. I could, you know, definitely think of publishing. I think I'd published maybe two poems coming into the program. So I think it was more, I was really a neophyte in that sense. So it was really a process of discovering both a community and write and connections with writers across the country, as well as then this like dawning, like, oh, I could, you know, teach, which I was able eventually to do, not only like with the local poetry center, but eventually at San Jose State University. So that was more of a surprise. But I feel like the another surprise was just this idea of connection, like connecting to you, you know, just knowing another poet in another place, and the not just the community, but the resource that that provides, and it makes you aware of what else is going on in the writing world. Right. So,
well, talking about the writing world, you've just contributed to the writing world. You have a new book, Listening to Mars, and this is I guess you could say this is a pandemic book. You have a quote in the front of your book that I read a few times, and it's taken from the Science Friday publication. The quote reads, "There are more individual viruses on planet Earth than stars in the universe." I read that several times. I mean, that made me like stop and
say, did that make you itch?
Maybe I didn't want to go outside anymore. You know? What I want to ask you, Sally Ashton, did the pandemic affect you on a personal level? Did you lose any friends or family members to COVID?
Yeah, it definitely affected me. I don't know how you could not be affected by this complete reframing of life, you know, where you go from your all of your outward connections and you're suddenly made in some ways a prisoner of your own home, and then you become a fearful prisoner of your own home. I did lose colleagues and a couple of friends who were already ill. I feel like that there were a lot of deaths that were propelled by COVID because of the addition of grief and fear.
And age probably too.
Yeah, and age. But, you know, one was a friend younger than myself, but she had cancer and she'd been, you know, things had been going well. And then, you know, her numbers took off. And yeah, and I mean, hers was a particularly tragic case, one of those things where you go in the hospital and then no one can reach you and, you know, just all of that. I'd also, my brother had died the year prior, so I was still already grieving that. So, yeah, it was. And then I have one grandchild and he was three, and I feel like I missed, you know, I'm very close to him. I was there at his birth. And so there was that sense of missing a whole stage. You know, at that age, you're just really, right. You come back 6 months later and it's a different person. That's a minor loss.
When did you know you were writing this book, Listening to Mars? You know, I can see, you know, many of us were writing during the pandemic. But when did you say, okay, I'm working on a book?
Yeah, that took a while because I couldn't imagine people wanting to read stuff about the pandemic. I still felt compelled to write about it, especially when I kind of made this connection with our shrinking personal lives and set against this expansion out into the universe that, you know, NASA really sort of took off during that period. Both with the Mars missions that are also part of the Artemis missions, which just seems such a disjuncture of it's, and they both seemed like equal science fictions, and you know, just very jarring. So I was writing, and then I had the privilege of I had just retired from San Jose State, and retired sounds funny, but yes. and they had me back to teach the grad seminar on Zoom anyway. And I was also teaching several workshops on what I was calling the COVID Chronicles. So that was trying to capture the moments that we were in. So I was doing a lot of focused writing about the now of the pandemic and leading people into doing that, wondering, other than like, this is great process for dealing with this time and space. And then I just started, you know, I had a lot that was not published, or had been not been pulled together. I mean, most of this book, other than maybe maybe five or six pieces were written during that time. There might be, six to 10 pieces kind of came pull just the way you make connections of like what's going on in your psyche with the moon or whatever. So I was able to get some studio time at Montalbo Art Center where I'm a fellow. And I just came with stacks of poems and did my like just started sorting. And it took a while to find the final form. But yeah, so that was 2022.
Yeah, well, let's go back to your childhood when you were growing before 2022. When you were growing up, did you have an interest in astronomy?
I did not necessarily have an interest in astronomy, but I lived here in the Santa Clara Valley. My dad had been got a new job at Lockheed Missiles and Space, and this was during the Apollo missions. So my dad was very, of course, engaged as all the adults were, and so that's what was on the TV, and we would talk about and watch any kind of the liftoffs. But we also had like we would do things, I think because things like satellites were so new to my parents, we would like go out and lay on blankets at night and like watch for satellites. So like from a young age, we were looking up and noticing the stars and the planets and particularly space travel. So that.
When we think about Mars, there's this fascination. Nikki Giovanni, there was a documentary released last year called "Going to Mars: The Nikki Giovanni Project," and she has a line saying, "Run away with the ants and live on Mars." Right? And I remember, the sitcom, my favorite Martian, with Bill Bixby and Ray Walton. I think that
I'm
was
so
around
glad you
64.
reminded me of that one.
And then there was the Martian Manhunter, John Jones in the comic strips,
Oh, okay.
so that was another one. But talk about that, because we're dealing with poetry, we're dealing with the imagination. Did you like get into science fiction and think about, oh, I want to move to Mars because my mother and father are not giving me the things I want here?
It was that's a good question about back then. Did I want to? Because right now I do not want to. You couldn't pay me. You could pay me. No. But I mean, it was more that, like you're saying with the comic strip, it was so inculcated into, we were being sold on space, and we are right now, by the way. NASA is really selling us on space. But I don't know if you ate Nabisco, well, whatever they were. It was that wheat cereal. Anyway, they had little spoon men and they were spacemen. And if you ate a box of cereal, you could get one of these little guys and he sat on your
That's
spoon.
during the time of Tang, when
Right.
the astronauts. Tang.
And then there was, not only my favorite Martian, but there was the Jetsons. And so I think that that leads your imagination into those spaces.
Well, that leads us into a point. I wanted you to read Space Travel Questionnaire.
Okay.
Know before you go. So if anyone listens or out there, they can check off the thing that they need to know before they go.
Well, I'm glad you asked me to read this one because it's one that I never read out loud because it just, I mean, the book isn't, I don't know. It's just, anyway, it just seems so negative. I don't know. Maybe not. You tell me what you think. All right. It's kind of a list poem, but it is in the form of a questionnaire. Space travel questionnaire. Know before you go. One, the universe, a vast expanse of empty space containing all of everything in existence, awaits. Would you say outer space is public or private? Two, who owns the Earth, stars, the asteroids, the moon, and all celestial bodies? Three, is the International Outer Space Treaty of 1967 still in effect? Four, all countries who sign the treaty agree to avoid, quote, the harmful contamination of space and celestial bodies, unquote. What would you consider harmful? 5. How do you define terra formation? 6. Which of the following did Apollo astronauts leave on the lunar surface? Footprints, thermometers, a box of mirrors, lunar landers, an aluminum hammer, 2 golf balls, moon rovers, a falcon feather, family photos, 96 bags of poop, faded U.S. flags. 7. When we crash spent rockets into Mars, the moon, or leave them adrift in space, is that contamination? 8. The treaty protects outer space and everything in it from national appropriation. Can a private company appropriate? 9. Who are the chief funders of space exploration? 10. Here's the one error, excuse me. 10. How will mining firms extract, control, and sell resources from a celestial body they cannot own or contaminate according to the Outer Space Treaty? 11. The treaty establishes the use of space exclusively for peaceful purposes. What new branch of the armed forces did the U.S. form in 2019? 13. Why do scientists believe their civilizations always self-destruct? Why do scientists believe that civilizations always self-destruct? 14. Why is space called the final frontier?
Sally Ashton reading from her book, Listening to Mars. You know, Sally, I thought, you know, we talk about this being a list poem, but I thought this is very important because it captured what I think what I see as a major concern. And that is the privatization of space. Right. You know, when we look at, you made reference to NASA, but, you know, you look at NASA opening the doors to Bezos, Musk, you know, this privatization. Then you also talk about the key thing you're saying about your family sitting on blankets looking at, waiting for to see satellites. Well, we know there's a lot of contamination up there in terms of things floating around, you know. Yeah. And I think this poem addresses that. I mean, if I'm a reader, you know, I'm interested in terms of what is the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, you know, right. What's in there. And then I thought of something very funny as you were reading. I thought deliberately there was no number 10. I didn't see that as being an error. I just thought the Dead Sea Scrolls or the Missing Commandments or something like that.
I love that. Right. That's exactly right. You win.
Yeah, the government doesn't want to know. Number 10 is, do you believe in UFOs? And because you're in California, you also say UFOs and space lasers.
Yeah. So for the listening audience who don't have the book, it is a typographical error that there's numeral 10 is missing, which is why I stumbled right over.
Right. Well, yeah. Let's read. You have a poem about Apollo 8, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's.
Apollo 8. You're talking about what they should have sent was a poet.
Right, what they should write, exactly.
Shall I go?
Yeah, and this is if you want to say that in terms of back in 1968, the Apollo circled the moon 10 times without landing, and the Frank Borman, who actually died last November at the age of 95, and then James Lovell and also William Anders was on the Apollo. So share this with us.
Okay. What they should have sent was a poet, Frank Borman, Apollo 8, the first mission to orbit the moon. What they should have sent was a poet, except Borman later said he hadn't said that, or maybe it was just what everyone else said he'd said, or wished he'd said, wished so hard that someone decided he had said it. Because if you say something enough times, he definitely said, the last thing I would have wanted on our crew was a poet, though this was years and years later. What he most remembers from halfway between the moon and Earth was watching Earth rise out of the ink black of space, lifting over the moon's bleak, dead landscape, a blue marble, a blue agate. What they should have sent, Frank Borman did say, was poets, because I don't think we captured in its entirety the grandeur of what we had seen. The astronauts thought what they'd seen, Earth alone in the empty space, would change everything. It was small enough, he added, you could cover it with your thumbnail. He just didn't want a poet trying to fly the thing.
Okay, Sally Ashton. Sally, you know, I want to connect this poem to something you said about some of your writing, and we were talking about the pandemic and the whole thing of grief. Here it is in terms of why are poets necessary in terms of one, if you see something that you say, wow, I'm speechless, okay, perhaps, you know, a poet who deals with words could fill this in. But then we know sometimes there's a, it's not something beautiful, but there's a certain horror. And so we say, okay, wow, you know, I'm less speechless. But if you are a poet, or if you're like, say, a war photographer, you have to keep snapping. This gets into the whole thing, I guess, the poetry of witness. But yeah. Talk about how you view yourself in terms of, one, the responsibility for you to describe certain things. Do you feel that as a poet that you have that responsibility?
Yeah, I feel as a human I do. And I guess poetry is the way I express it. If I was a photographer and I could get in the right places, then I'd probably snap photographs. It's that kind of feeling of what's going on. You know, the song, What's Going On? when you kind of become aware of something. And I think that was part of the impetus during the pandemic when we were so like focused on survival, more or less, and on, you know, washing and masks and doorknobs and, you know, getting groceries and toilet paper. At the same time, out there's a lot of something going on. And I think a lot of these poems are trying to get at that, like trying to like, how do you talk about what's going on that doesn't just become a blah, 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 that someone, you turn off the news or something. So, you know, that's a funny feeling to feel like you need to say something that sounds very self-important. But that's what I'm doing. So, you know, I guess I feel like, I feel like I should or must or.
What about the spiritual side of your work? I mean, many times people look up at the stars and they say, okay, is there life out there? Who am I? You know, where did life begin? I mean, if you look at your book in terms of, and this is going to lead into this next poem I want you to read about Buddha Holds Up the Earth. Do you feel yourself in terms of this book changing you in terms of spiritually? Like you say, okay, are we alone here in the universe? Is it, you know?
Right. Yeah, I think I don't know if it was part of an instrument of change or allow helping me to kind of solidify, I think, what I'm feeling in terms of my place in our place in the universe, our kind of inability to know God, since there's like the boundaries, you know, of where heaven, quote unquote, is supposed to be, just keeps getting further away instead of like closer to us. And just the hugeness of things to me really opens up our very small concepts of who we are and what we're in the midst of.
Mm-hmm. We're in the midst of this conversation this morning. And before we go into the break, I want you to read Buddha Holds Up the Earth before we have our break.
All right. Buddha holds up the earth. You must stand gently. Earth presses against your foot. A breath inhaled, the hands palm up, lift past the belly, the chest, then flip to push skyward at shoulder height. Still the breath sucked in until the rising hands meet overhead. hold there, as if you are the Buddha, as if your lifted hands do hold the world's weight, unlike Atlas, crushed forever beneath its unending curvature, its pain. Flip palms down and push your breath out, a slow release, past your head, your heart, something moving with them. Hands cup again below, empty, full, ready for the next inhalation to rise once more as you rise each new day, not Buddha or any of those names, just you, your breath, your hands, your thoughts rising, falling, hold up the earth.
Listening to Sally Ashton, who's my guest this morning on our show, On the Margin. And we're going to take a little break. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's On the Margin. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Let's welcome music royalty, The Whisperers, performing all their classic songs for two big shows on Friday, April 26th at 8:30 p.m. and again on Saturday, April 27th at 8 p.m. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalimar, for two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. The Whisperers on April 26th and 27th, Trouble Funk featuring Big Tony on May 3rd, and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Sally Ashton. Sally Ashton is the former poet laureate of the Santa Clara County in California. We're talking about your book, Listening to Mars, Sally. One of the things that, maybe you've seen this in terms of the movie, one of the things that there's always somebody that takes that spacewalk and it gets trapped outside. You know, there's a little life cord and it's floating there. And then they just disappear off into the darkness.
Right.
And so, you know, and then with that whole thing, I remember the first spacewalk where you're actually going to step outside of your capsule. You know, it's like coming out of the womb, you know.
Yeah.
Talk about how you react to the space. I mean, that's how I reacted to the spacewalk.
Yeah. I don't think I was thinking out of the womb, but I was... I hadn't gotten there yet. And
you're still being born, Sally.
Yeah, right. I guess my feeling was just how tenuous and how terrifying to do that. And I think it probably what I almost like, you know how your your memories sort of meld together. So I kind of start remembering 2001 Space Odyssey spacewalk when Frank or whatever his name is, gets, separated by hell and just shoots off into the neverness of the universe. Is probably more, kind of inflex or reflex how it feels to me, very terrifying. At the same time, they're just kind of calmly going out with their bag of tools and banging around on this very delicate little, this is your only way home. I hope you've got the right screwdriver out there or you don't like accidentally.
I look at this and I said, this is a good example of a poem to share, Sally Ashton, with people who say, okay, I'm really afraid of open mic. I've never read in public before. And you just, just take a spacewalk.
Yeah, right.
why don't you read the poem of spacewalk, Sally?
Spacewalk, okay.
Before we get silly and they just shut us down.
Okay. All right. Spacewalk. Outside the spacecraft, tethered by barely a thread, the astronaut swims in a sea of nothing, far from any knowns. Swaddled like an infant must be, flung out for science, for discovery, for repairs. A frontier, always what's next, part of a grand adventure, home a frangible concept ever rippling outward with her, unmoored in concentric circles. She's given herself to them, to the challenge, sometimes horror, to see so much, so clearly, where she floats in low Earth orbit, traveling 28,000 kilometers per hour. An eerie stillness circling Earth every 90 minutes. Enormous planet suspended in space-time, as she is suspended, waiting to climb back aboard. Her life hurtling through that vacuum, not flat, as the world was once believed to be, even her DNA changing. O celestial body, one of us, we peer beyond the edges of the cracked ceiling world, acquainted with the dark, speeding toward uncertainty, slipping the margins of time.
Thank you, Sally Ashton. Sally, when I look through your listening to Mars, one of the things that becomes very apparent to the reader, you have a number of prose poems, you have different forms. You read like a list poem which we just shared with us. Some of that seems like that's also a found poem in terms of how you gather this stuff. But for those of us who are writers who are listening to us today, what form do you feel comfortable in? And did you, for example, because you're now dealing with like astronomy and science, do you feel now that that lends itself to a prose poem because there's more information that you're trying to convey to the reader, that you're more concerned about content as opposed to, say, the sound of what I want to say in a particular line?
Yeah. I feel like I'm always interested in the sound and the rhythm. I try to. And I think that's an insightful observation that probably the more informational poems, although I'm thinking of another one you want me to read that's loaded with information that I felt like I really needed the line break to meter. There's an idea of a longer line, which you get the feeling more for in a prose poem as being kind of more, not philosophical, but maybe more thoughtful. There's more thought carried in the longer sentence anyway, that then is not interrupted by the artificial line break. A lot of that for me has to do with pacing of impact and breath and musicality. And I don't know, because I do so much pre-writing in a journal, which is also, I don't so often do a line break in a journal. I'm using the margins. It's a kind of a, you know, it's about this size, which is sort of a prose poem size.
Sort of your William Carlos Williams approach to writing.
Yeah. But then on the other hand, there's a practice that I got at Bennington. It was at least from David Lehman about like writing a 5-word line and just making yourself turn. And that kind of got habituated too. So sometimes I'm kind of juggling, and sometimes the 5-word line goes into a prose poem. It just like once the poem finds its grounded voice, then I think I feel like I know if I'm working with the little prose block of a prose poem or with stanzas. I've got sort of modulated sonnet in here and a form I made up that someone recently said I should call a haiku because a pantoum and a haiku mixed anyway.
Well, you know, one of the things that one finds when you look at your book on Listening to Mars, you have in the back notes. And I was wondering in terms of as for other people who are listening, when should a poet have notes in terms of what becomes essential information? And this is how you deal with notes as opposed to footnotes in a poem.
Yeah. Yeah, I think footnotes to me is just too intrusive.
A visual distraction.
Yeah, visual distraction. It takes you out of the moment of the poem. So my notes would end up being things that I feel like I want to give credit to. It's also sort of the teacher in me. Like, so if I'm wanting to suggest that, you know, like, oh, for that phrase came from Elizabeth Bishop's poem. You know, I just like to, I guess I feel kind of instructive in that. And also just to show an appreciation for the legacy of poets and ideas that become the poet draws from the world. And there's a part that germinates with my own imagination, but, you know, we're all writing together.
But how often does, you know, we have these notes, and that's you as the writer explaining why you want to have the notes there. But sometimes the reader looks, picks up the book, and the notes might be the index or something like that. Yeah. They're not going to read that. And I think of how sometimes in the Best American Poetry for the particular year, they have in the back of the poet describing the poem.
Yeah.
And someone would say, okay, if I'm doing reading your poems, I'd ask them, just make me do the heavy lifting. Let me look up something.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't need the notes. Especially with Google now, I'll read your poem while I have my phone in my hand. If anything I need to know, I'll just access it. So we can save some pages here.
Okay.
But,
all right.
But I say that in terms of, on a serious note, in terms of how one should read this book, like it seems as if for what you're saying, you went through the task of putting these notes there. They're just as important as, say, some of the epigraph that you had in the beginning, like that.
Yeah.
I've got attracted to.
Yeah, and I think particularly, you know, a couple of these things are like where you can go and see the video that, you know, was just like so kind of paradigm shifting, you know, for me. Or you can go and see this crazy owl perched on that flew inside a helicopter that was in the middle of water dumps, you know, where to me, that's like cool stuff. I would want to know.
Well, talk about cool stuff. I'm wondering that how much joy did it have for you to be the poet laureate of Santa Clara County in California? I believe you might've been the second poet laureate.
Yeah, the second poem. I didn't hear the first part of the question. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just wondered how you felt in terms of, you know, that's an honor. You know, today we have a number of poet laureates across the country. You came up with a project in terms of the favorite poem project, which sounded a little bit like Robert Pinsky.
Oh, yeah, totally Robert Pinsky. Yeah, I just brought it.
I didn't see any footnote about Robert Pinsky.
Oh, sorry. Well, you didn't come to all my presentations. Yeah. They don't care about footnotes at the county level. You know?
Well, talk about that project. Talk about that link to Pinsky and also how your community responded, because Pinsky found that it was very, very important.
Yeah. So I followed Nils Petersen, who was the first county poet laureate, and he was reaching out, well, to everyone in the county, but he was doing a lot of projects for poets. And so as number two, I felt like, okay, I want to now see how better to include people who would never consider writing a poem and trying to entice them. So so the favorite poem of project, for those who don't understand it just by hearing it, is you just choose a poem that's been meaningful to you. I had, and this way, it wasn't like write a poem and I'll judge it, and if I like it good and, you know, good enough, I'll include it in something. Right. It was like, okay, whatever you send me, as long as you send me 100 words of why, then I'm going to put it on this blog, and, you know, that you can now send to your grandmother or granddaughter or whatever. And so it was, and then I made kind of strategic asks of, officials, you know, mayors and whatever kind of Christy Yamaguchi and, you know, different kind of well-known people that would spread that out a little further, and schools, you know, of course, my university. Yeah. And it was a really good response, I felt, for being an area that's very busy, very tech oriented, very STEM oriented. It was a good way to.
Was there anything that surprised you in terms of selections that people had, or were there anything that people had like some of the same poems?
Yeah, sometimes there would be the same poems, but now we're talking 2011. So I'm not going to be able to pull those out. But I think I was surprised at how personal people were willing to respond. Like, I'd just been through a divorce, or, you know, some really deep stuff. They knew it was going on a blog. And this was before a lot of social media where everyone's, you know, talking about all their personal things. And surprising poems that I, you know, wasn't expecting. And of course, a lot that I was not expecting, but I was familiar with.
Well, you're in California. I was wondering how diverse did people remember poems from, like, maybe countries they were from?
I was doing favorite poem readings, and at Christmas time I did one that was bring your native language poem, or your, you know, first language poem. People did not submit those to the favorite poem project that I can recall. They didn't. I think pretty much everybody, but that would have been, you know.
We're not putting you on the spot, Sally Ashton, but do you have a favorite poem? did you stir the pot with something that
you had? Yeah, I'm trying. Yeah, what did I? No, I have to go back and look. The first poem that springs to mind, which is, someone recently asked me about the favorite poems out of the book. And it's, you know, it's like, that's hard. Dumb quote. No, not dumb. But a significant poem for me is something I came across in my undergrad, my back to school. And I will add that I basically had no background in literature until I returned to the university in my 30s. And that's a whole different story. And if, you know, anyway, so Emily Dickinson's My Life Had Stood a Loaded Gun really connected with what I felt was like this discovery of self and power, mm-hmm. that my life had stood in corners. My life had stood a loaded gun in corners till the day the master came, identified, and carried me away. Yeah. So that was, I don't know if that's my favorite, but it's definitely was one that, like, I felt like I was in the room with Emily Dickinson somehow. It was bizarre. Anyway.
Okay. I want to bring you back. You've done something which I think is very important in terms of giving back in terms of community. You are entering the DMQ review. And talk about, you know, how that was created, the task it is in terms of sustaining it. You know, we were talking about the creative writing program and being in a program and raising your family and having time to study and stuff like that. But doing a magazine and keeping it going is also a commitment. Talk about that.
It's huge. Yeah, this is my, formally my 20th year as editor-in-chief. The journal itself was begun in 1998. So it's like, Terrain says they're the oldest online journal, so I'll give them that. But we're pretty close to being one of the oldest online journals. And it was started by a poet who was in the tech industry with a couple of his buddies, and they put, you know, they made this thing online. And it was very, again, unique for the time. It was also like nobody trusted that was really publication. So that whole kind of morph from now, like every journal has got some sort of online presence for the most part. I had been published. These people were local. I had had a couple of poems published while I was at Bennington in the journal. And then at a certain point, somewhere around 2003, the founding editor, his name is J.P. Dancing Bear, wanted to go and do something brand new in a print journal, and he started contacting people he'd published to see if anybody wanted to take it over. And this was right after I'd graduated. One of the things I decided was I was just going to say yes to everything. it sounds very, very silly. But I mean, because I had said no to so much, I felt like when you say yes to something, you rise to it. You know, so I had done book reviews and interviews and stuff I would have thought to do. Anyway, so I said yes and took it on. So that was how I came to it. It's a DMQ, so Disquieting Muses Quarterly. I couldn't keep up quarterly eventually. You go through, different editors, everybody's volunteer. And I feel like it is definitely a service. Right now we're focusing on the prose poem. There isn't really that many venues that are just prose poem. And God bless my editorial team. And I keep it afloat financially. So it's very, I feel like that's, you know, maybe I'm not subscribing to a lot of other journals, but I feel like I'm doing this one. And, you know, there, because I was grandfathered into different, you know, like the early submittable. So yeah, it works for now.
I want to ask you, because when Jody Bowles and I was editing Portlore magazine, there was something that we decided we would really commit ourselves to as editors, because we saw there was definitely a need. And that was the long poem. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm always against, like, somebody submits a long poem, you don't want to just run an excerpt. You want to have the whole thing. I'm wondering now, since things are online, that, you know, it's sort of like a battle, because people say, well, what is the attention span online reading and stuff like that? But it seems also at the same time, you're not dealing with a page count. You can just post something that's long.
Right.
What's your commitment to the long poem as an editor?
Yeah, right now I'm not.
Oh, this could be this. And that'll be no more questions for you, Sally Ashton.
No, it's because we are doing the prose poem, so you're getting a lot of words in a smaller space. You know,
wait, stop right there. I'm in Washington. Yeah. Don't feel a buster this way. Come on, you know what I'm saying. You're one of those last states to come into the union. Give me a better answer, Sally Ashton. The long poem is completely different from a prose poem.
You're getting 500 words and that's it, because I've got to read three of them, and that's 1,500 words. So, that's a slush pile for you, okay? Every submission, it could be 1,500 words. So, yeah, it is. I do have limited resource, not only money, but just time. Right. So those are the things that, you know, we used to be like, three to five poems. And now with the prose poems, it's like three poems. It's because we're getting a lot more submissions. So getting,
you know, I'm just thinking of like some, you know, the future Dirt Walcotts and people like that, who you have these long book length poems, you know,
or even,
you know, I'm getting ready to talk to Ed Hirsch, you know, Gabriel, you know, you have poets who just, they love this form.
Yeah.
And here it is, as if, for example, we can't place it, you know, and that's what my concern is about.
Yeah. But on the other hand, I feel like I'm reading more or seeing more and more book length, you know, like memoirs in verse. Right. And,
but that's book length. But we're talking about what's the responsibility of a magazine.
Right. Okay. Not mine.
Not mine. Okay.
I'm doing what I can do. All right. I'm ministering to the prose poem world, the long poem world.
Well, you said something, and this comes to the end of our program, Sally Ashton, something that I wonder about whether you see the importance of in terms of, once again, service. But, and that is, many books come out, just like yours, you know, listening to Marcia's out. And it just seems to be a need and a place for people to review poetry books.
Yeah.
You know, for people to write reviews, to read reviews. So talk about that.
Yeah. And we had, I think it's really important. I need an editor for that if we were going to take it on. And I did have, I'm trying to think what we were calling, they were micro reviews. We did a couple of issues back right before the pandemic, I think. And I had a special projects editor and she, you know, pulled these things together. And I've done in other, four other magazines, you know, not many, but several, you know, book reviews. I think they are super important. But again, for me, it, you know, if we're talking about specifically DMQ review, I just have like, I have bandwidth that I have learned. I can't do all this stuff.
But I'll come back full circle because when we started this conversation, we were talking about the Benedictine writing seminars and writing the book reviews was a key part.
Yeah.
Of the learning experience there.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really like your book review, Sally Ashton. I just want to let you know for the record. I don't know how you got out of the program, Sally.
Oh, sad.
I want to invite that. I have a lot of admiration for you. I mean, it's sort of like, I'm just glad that we stayed in touch and you're doing wonderful stuff. And I'm just very, very proud of you in terms of that. And I hope you continue providing service to others because you're a gem.
Okay. Oh, all right.
My guest has been Sally Ashton. She's a writer and teacher. She's the editor of the DMQ Review. From 2011 to 2013, she served as the Poet Laureate of Santa Clara County, California. We've been hearing a list of reading from her book, Listening to Mars, published by Cornerstone Press. The show's On the Margin. My name is E.S. Burt Miller. The station's WPFW 89.3 FM.
Remember Freestyle Union from back in the 90s in DC? Or if you ever heard jazz legend Steve Coleman playing with a virtuoso rapper? Or if you've just been keeping up with what's going on in the DMV right now, then you know the artist that is Kokai. one of DC's most original talents, an author, improviser, storyteller, and 2023 Guggenheim Fellow, Kokai, comes to Songbird Music House on April 28th for a special concert with his live band, presented by Capital Bop. That's Sunday, April 28th, at Songbird in Northeast DC. Also on the bill is Baltimore's Conjure Collective, a new group you won't want to miss. Info at capitalbop.com. That's CAPITALBOP.com.